This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Welcome to another landmark talk, everyone. Thanks for coming out in the rain. For those that are new to... Speak up, Liz. Hi. For those of you that are new to the event, my name is Frances Baldwin and I'm currently looking after the Museum Friends. Before we begin, just the normal administration, if you could please turn your phones to silent. And as the session is going to be recorded and transcribed by the lovely Polly down here, if you could wait for the microphones at the end. Come in, ladies. There's a couple of seats down here for you for questions. I'd also like to draw your attention to the Museum's Defining Moments project. You'll find some cards down on the front, which I had actually put on your seats, but the cleaner has thrown them out, unfortunately, plus the reserve sign, so I'm sorry if you're not sitting where you need to sit. And we'd be very interested in your feedback of what you think that your defining moments are in this commemorative year, 2015. Of course, the museum will have a plaque commemorating the 1915 moment Australian troops landed in Gallipoli in one of our series of 25 plaques to go on the floor in the hall. So please keep your eyes on the hall for changing elements of this exhibition, and also if you've got the opportunity to go online or give us your feedback on the cards, we'd really appreciate it, as it'll go to inform this project. There's also a series of lectures around the new exhibition, The Home Front, with the first one being on the 7th of May at 12:30 with two of the curators that put the Home Front exhibition together. So that's one of the reasons that I invited Felicity to speak today. And on to today, a very special welcome to Felicity Packard, one of the writers behind the six acclaimed Underbelly drama series and lead writer and producer on Anzac Girls, which screened on the ABC and is currently also on iView, I believe. It's just recently been nominated for 3 Logies, including Outstanding Miniseries, so congratulations to Felicity on that. She's also written for many other TV shows, including Home and Away, and over the years has won many prizes for her screenwriting, including the 2008 Queensland Premier's Literary Award and 5 Orgies, which are the Australian Writers Guild Awards. A part-time lecturer at the Facility of Arts and Design at the University of Canberra, Felicity teaches across a range of creative writing-related subjects, including screenwriting, prose writing, and literary studies. As well as having a family and a normal social life, she's currently developing Wolf Creek as a television series for Stan and undertaking a PhD in screenwriting. Plus, she's a TV-aholic like myself, so that's exciting. Please join me today for another very esteemed landmark lecture with Felicity Packard. Thank you.
Oh, hello, and thank you very much for having me here and for turning up on this wet morning. It was really lovely to be asked as a landmark woman, and that's... I never thought of myself like that. And it's enormously, you know, humbling to see the other people, other speakers who've been asked to speak at this event. Though when it comes to landmark women, let me tell you, I've got nothing on the people that I want to talk about today, which is the women we represented in Anzac Girls. What I do want to talk about today is the kind of personal journey I had through Anzac Girls and why we decided to tell the story in the first place. When I say we, it's myself as the sort of lead writer and creator, and then the other producers and the executive producers, and of course the Screen Time, the production company, and the ABC. Because there's lots of reasons to... You need good reasons to spend the amount of money that the ABC spent on a show like Anzac Girls, and particularly in what was going to be a saturated climate, which is where I'd like to start. So I've called my talk Great Deeds in the Great War, but really what I want to talk about is how so many of these great deeds done by these women are just unknown because they were nurses and because they were women. And I think it's what we tried to do in Anzac Girls is open that up, and I just want to talk about that a little. And I'll need to put my glasses up and down because I can't see properly. All right. So first of all, I want to talk about where the idea came from and why we chose back in 2013 it must have been, we started, or 2012 we started thinking about this. We were aware that there was the centenary of the Gallipoli landing and of the whole of World War One was approaching, and all the networks, all the TV networks, were very keen to do as you can see now from the amount of material on there, to do stories about that's commemorated that. And we were looking for something that gave a point of difference, because we knew that there were lots of other Gallipoli projects out there. There's already been Gallipoli, which is on Channel 9, and there's one called Get Deadline Gallipoli, which is on Foxtel, plus lots of documentaries and dramatised documentaries and things like that. So we were really keen to find something that was different. And stories of nurses was, of course, something that was different, because nurses tend to be sort of, if they appear at all, they just sort of seem to minister to wounds and then disappear again. So we were attracted to that. Why I also was very attracted to the idea of looking at the Gallipoli story from a different point of view is I'm old enough to remember and to have admired and have imprinted on my mind's eye Peter Weir's 1981 film Gallipoli, which is quite extraordinary. They actually on Four Corners this week, Chris Masters' wonderful sort of account of Gallipoli and comparing it to what the Afghanistan veterans are going through. They used footage from Peter Weir's film a lot, the Battle of the Neck, when people just going over the top endlessly. It was very disturbing and very powerful image. And so I felt, for me, as a just not for others, because I know there are many people much younger than me in Australia, but for me, that story had been told. I didn't need to see that story. I didn't need to be that engaged creatively in that story again. So again, Anzac Girls the story of nurses gave us something to a fresh approach, a fresh lens. I was also very attracted, kind of perversely, to the idea of doing a war story that didn't go to the war, that didn't go to the front line. I think there was something about, because so much of war happens at the front line, but an enormous amount happens behind that front line. And I was interested in kind of pulling apart what that might look like. So I came across this book, which is called The Other Anzacs, by Peter Rees, who is another Canberran. He's a former journalist and now a historian. And this is the book on which we obtained the rights to this book and used this as the basis of our research for Anzac Girls. It's now been re-released as the same book, but with Anzac Girls on the cover, as a sort of movie tie-in, as it were. I was really attracted to it because it's about real people and nurses rather than soldiers. It's based, and it draws heavily on the nurses' diaries and letters and things like that. It's a very unknown story. Despite, I know we have the Nurses' Memorial, which I want to talk about later on, and there was a wonderful travelling exhibition at the Australian War Memorial about nurses a few years ago, but really it's a very unknown story. The whole Australian Army Nursing Service story is undertold, underexplored. Peter's book, it was really good at capturing the people as well as the events. He actually looks at about 30 nurses from both Australia and New Zealand in his book. And, of course, we had to whittle that down. We can't look at all of those people. But he really captured a sense of their personal journeys as well as the dates. And he slotted those really nicely into the dates and battles and things like that. And having come off the back of six series of Underbelly, I'm very attracted to the appeal of real events and the dramatic possibilities in real events and how you make... Real life is so crazy. Real life is so disorganised and it does not fit neatly into a three-act structure, because generally we like, for drama, we like a beginning and a middle and an end in that order. And real life just isn't like that. So I've really enjoyed and risen to the... I tried to rise to the challenge of taking real events and, without betraying the history of them, turning them into something that's an accessible piece of drama. And I just kind of like that. So, other reasons that why Anzac Girls, or the telling stories of Anzac nurses, appeal to me personally. My parents, my whole family are New Zealanders. I was the only one in my family actually born in Australia, so I have a strong New Zealand heritage. And I was... And I've always been terribly conscious that this word here, actually, acronym, actually has New Zealand in it. as well as Australia. And living in Australia, we could completely forget that New Zealand was there. And I have to say, it's exactly the same in New Zealand. When you go to New Zealand Anzac ceremonies and Gallipoli ceremonies, it's like Australia wasn't there. So both countries have sort of isolated each other out. Maybe it's to do with the All Blacks. I don't know. But for some reason, they don't really engage with the fact that it was the Australian-New Zealand Army Corps. It wasn't the Australian Army Corps or the New Zealand Army Corps. It was something that was bundled together. And, you know, we share... If there's a story here, if there are stories from that time, from that period, both countries share them equally. And I was very happy to remind audiences of that. Another reason was... Look, I'm a very proud Australian. I'm a proud Australian. I went to school and we used to sing every year. It's a lead up to Anzac Day. We'd sing, you know, the songs and I've been to the dawn services and things like that. And I think it's a really remarkable kind of social thing that happens in Australia and New Zealand around Anzac Day. And there is absolutely no place for a woman in it. There's just not a woman in it. That's because women didn't land at Gallipoli on April 25. I can understand that. But the fact is, there was a whole lot of other women, a whole lot of women doing things behind the scenes, which made that whole experience and on into the rest of the First World War possible. And so I was very keen to sort of see ways in which we could enlarge that story to let the female element come out. I have a lot of nursing connections. I have a daughter who's a midwife. I've got three sisters-in-law who are nurses, so nurses figure very heavily in my family. And so I'm always happy to be pro-nurse. Not anti-doctor, but pro-nurse. But that's a little anti-doctor sometimes. But in general, it's a way of celebrating that nursing work. I think nursing work needs to be celebrated and honoured and dramatised as often as possible. I also have a lot of World War I medical connections. My grandfather, they're all New Zealanders, of course. My grandfather served as a doctor in both the Middle East and on the Western Front. My aunt, actually, as a Kiwi, like Hilda Steele, one of our characters, served with the Australians, even though she was a Kiwi nurse. And I have a great uncle who was killed on the Western Front. So we have lots, from both sides of my family, we have lots and lots of medical connections and wartime connections into the First World War. So it's always been a story that's rolled around our family. And then there's a whole lot of gender politics which comes into it, which I will return to but when I stand on my soapbox towards the end of this little chat. All right. Another thing with Anzac Girls I was really attracted to doing is unpacking and kind of re-experiencing and rethinking this whole idea of Gallipoli and Anzac and what they mean. And as we've seen just in the last few days with the commercialisation, the controversy about commercialisation of the word Anzac and the whole lest we forget and fresh in our memories and very, very tacky things like that. It's a vexed issue for both countries. That's arisen later, but at the time, when I was thinking about Anzac Girls, I was thinking, when we say the word Anzac, it's just such a positive in general in Australia and New Zealand. It is such, the connotations are universally positive. They evoke these qualities, mateship and sacrifice and humour in the face of adversity and courage and loyalty and all of those sorts of things, and this whole crucible of national identity and all of that, and it's, which is, you know, that's fine and it's true, but again, I just thought, what might it see if those very genuinely valorised concepts were seen through a female lens? Because mateship has such male connotations, because we think of it as we think mateships and we see a bronzed Aussie going over the top, you know, and it's, what might that mean if you just thought about it, if you had enlarged that legend a little? So it's wanting to see what it might mean if you opened them up. It's like with mateship, I think in Anzac Girls we did things like explore friendship, which doesn't have, it's not exactly the same word, but it's the same thing. If we think of mateship as loving support and loyalty and having your mate's back, having a friend's back, well, I think we explore that in Anzac Girls in a different way. It's not this, it's because as soon as you apply it to women, it just comes out slightly different, but that's one of the things I wanted to look at. The idea of sacrifice, oh my goodness, I mean, sacrifice for a soldier, it's very clear. I mean, many of them, thousands of them tragically paid with their lives or paid with terrible wounds that they carry forever, both emotional and physical. But so that's also why women have been excluded, because they didn't pay that sort of really obvious price. But if you watched Anzac Girls and reading through all the material, you realise that there was a lot of... They had enormous sacrifices. They sacrificed health and happiness. They sacrificed their futures. Only 30% of nurses who returned from the war actually married when they came back. You know, that was they'd given up something to do this. Lots of them went against their parents' approval. There's a scene in episode 2 and 3 where Olive Haynes had suffered enormous pressure from her parents not to go to war. And that's, we didn't make that up. That was her experience, and it's in her letters. So it's a different sort of sacrifice, but I think it's still one that was worth exploring and dramatising. Humour. Our girls are so great, especially Olive, but they were all so funny. They said wonderful things, lots of lines which got cut, not because they weren't good lines, just because that's how things end up on the cutting room floor. But, you know, Olive used to go around and say, you know, I'll do my best for you. You're going to have to look a bit more cheerful. You know, or you'll be wanting flowers on your grave next year. They'd ask for a glass of water. Oh, you'll be wanting flowers on your grave next. I haven't got time for that. They're very funny. It's that same sort of black humour that obviously men in the trenches you need, or people under any sort of pressure. There's a lot of gallows humour in medicine generally, because otherwise you can't cope. It's just too disturbing. So the nurses had that too, but that's not a story that we get told. We tend to think of nurses, and I'll come to this in a minute too, as those ministering angels who sort of hover in and just glide around and do angelic things and glide off again. But actually they were full-blooded, humorous women, people, and I think that was worth exploring. And how that might, again, just be a little bit different to the sort of way that we understood that quality. Courage, in particular. Oh, courage. Oh, my goodness. I think this is almost the biggest one. I was really concerned to explore the different sorts of courage that were required by the women in the AANS. They didn't have to go over the top. They weren't being asked to put their lives on the line in that same really direct way that men were. But they had to have the courage to keep going. All the women, the 5 women who we look at, they served virtually the entire war. And for a lot of that, they're working 16-hour shifts for 14 days straight. And they're having between 1 and 20 men die in a shift. Yeah, the courage to keep going and do that, I think, is something that's worth celebrating. But it's not something that we're kind of allowed to do in the particular version of Anzac Day that the media tends to generally deliver us. It's also the courage to sit with people, to sit with people who are dying. It takes an enormous amount of courage. Most of us just turn tail and flee. It's just too hard. Now, these nurses had to do it time after time. In one episode, we dramatise an absolutely true event or true sequence of events where the nurses wrote letters to the loved ones of the soldiers who died. So the army would send home a telegram, "We regret to inform you that," didn't tell you very much and was poor little comfort to a mother, and the nurses would write to them. The emotional toll that must have taken, the courage to just think, "Oh, I've got to pick up my pen and do it again," and still they did it, I think is worth honouring and celebrating. Sorry, I'm already on my soapbox, as you can see. So, yes, we've talked about that. It's all about... I've gone the wrong way. The other thing I wanted to talk about, wanted to explore, was this idea that Anzac and Gallipoli as the birthplace of Australia. And New Zealand makes the same claim. Actually, Paul Keating, the former Prime Minister, is very interesting on this, and he's very anti that idea. He thinks that it's a false notion, but I'll leave him to make that argument. I did want to look at that, though, and just what that might have been like. What did they think at the time? Did they have that sense of it at the time? Were they thinking in those large kind of nationalistic terms? And so you read the diaries and the letters, and you actually come up with some remarkable things that the Anzac nurses experienced. What they had to say about Gallipoli was almost from the word go, it was stupid, it was a disaster, it was a waste of time. and that it was poorly managed. Not only the women that we look at, one wonderful nurse whose story we didn't dramatise because there's just too much material, but she was writing angrily in her diary that those, she called them, those imbeciles in British high command should be sacked, you know, and she would have been sent home for writing that if that had got past the censors. You know, they were feeling that sense that Australians and New Zealanders were being used as cannon fodder. And I know a lot of British people, many British and French, and of course the Turks died in enormous numbers in that campaign. But I'm thinking about it from our point of view, from the Anzac nurses' point of view. The other thing that was clear very swiftly it's a theme that riffs right through all the nurses' diaries and letters throughout the whole war, was their dismay, first of all their disbelief, and then their dismay, and then their severe displeasure at how they were treated by the colonial authorities by their British counterparts. Now, not all of them, of course. They also say very nice things about a lovely British nurse here and a, you know, charming British doctor there. But the general feeling is that these Australians and New Zealanders went over there saying, look, here we are, little part of Britain. And the British didn't want to know, were happy to use them, but did not see them as equals. And so there's a line in episode 4 where Alice says, she's cross, this is actually in the Western Front, and she turns to somebody and she says, honestly, the way we're being treated here, you'd think we were England's enemies instead of belonging to her. That is straight from her diary. That was straight from her diary. And that sentiment is something that gets repeated or gets explored in so many of their diaries and letters home. And they were stunned. They seriously, it was like a slap in the face. They had no idea that they wouldn't, that Britain didn't see the colonies in the same kind of affectionate and equal way that the colonies saw Britain. And so, not very far into the war, Olive's saying things like, you know, it was in the Western Front, actually. She said, I've been to London, it's a gilded fog bowl, there's no place like Australia. Now, that's partly homesickness, of course, but it is, before that, at the beginning of the war, she's saying, I can't wait to get there, see home. She was born in Adelaide, but, you know, I can't wait to go home. That whole idea of home, she gets in, it's just got nothing to do with her as far as she's concerned. So that was part of, I was really interested in kind of exploring that as well. Another nice little example, which we again dramatised because it was too good to miss, was the fuss about the red capes, the scarlet capes that they wore, those lovely scarlet capes, because the British had suggested that, they'd made a rule, just I don't know where it came from, that only the Queen Alexandra's Imperial Nursing Service nurses should wear the scarlet cape. And in came these Australians and New Zealanders cheerfully wearing their scarlet capes, and they had incredible pressure not to wear them, though they went on and did. But it's those sorts of things which that for the people from the Antipodes found really, really surprising. Yet they boldly went on. Another thing that I think, another element of the whole kind of World War I story, but particularly Gallipoli, that I think I think Anzac Girls allows us to explore, is this idea of the Australian Army, because we don't spend much time with the New Zealand Army, so I can't speak for that. The AIF, the Australian Imperial Force, which was what the army was called in for the First World War, tends to come out very clean and shiny in the public mind. We just think, oh, those brave men who are being mistreated by the British. Well, that's not how the nurses experienced it. The nurses experienced almost equal, you know, hostility and downright misogyny from the Australian Army as they did from anywhere else. And I think just being able to have a chance to pull that apart and just look at that and just remind people that these are lived experiences and that the whole Gallipoli legend thing is, it's, there's a whole reality to it that we don't generally look at. And I think that looking at Anzac Girls, dramatising Anzac Girls allowed us to do that. An example of the way in which they were treated is through Colonel Fieschi, who was played by, I've just forgotten his name, isn't that terrible? It's series episode 2 and 3. And he's the commander on Lemnos, which is where this photograph is from. Grace Wilson on Lemnos. She was the matron in charge of number 3 AGH there. And he made their lives miserable. He went out of his way to make the nurses' lives unpleasant. He undervalued their contribution, even though Grace Wilson's hospital, she was such an extraordinary nurse and was so good with how she ran the wards, that, you know, the mortality rate was incredibly low, lower than at any other hospital. And that's why she ended up winning a Royal Red Cross first class for her management there. But at the time, this is actually a quote from a historian of called Kirsty Harris, who's written a wonderful book called More Than Bombs and Bandages about the World War I nurses. This is just what she says. Medical men of the day were loath to attribute reduced death rates to nursing and imply that it was because of the doctor's involvement rather than constant nursing work that patients survived. And so that was a... To dramatise that, I think, was a really important thing, a way of reclaiming that kind of aspect of the story. Other ways in which, just to dramatise, to demonstrate the truly appalling way they were treated is, they were officers, they were ranked as officers, but the untrained orderlies, who are privates, wouldn't take orders from them. They did eventually, by the time they got to the Western Front, things had improved. But certainly to begin with, there was no they wouldn't take orders from a woman. And to join the Australian Army Nursing Service, and this was the same for New Zealand more or less, they had to be qualified nurses. They had to have already qualified, which meant they had to have done 3 years training plus a year at a hospital. And they had to be between 21 and 40 and be unmarried and all those sorts of things. But they were fully qualified, experienced people who got paid less than half what an untrained orderly did. You know, the baker joins up and says, I'll be an orderly. Good on him. He got paid twice what Mate Grace Wilson got. You know, so I think when that scene got cut, no, just we couldn't fit it in. I couldn't fit everything in that it wanted to fit in. But that, I'm telling you guys, so you can know that. That sort of thing, I think, is also one of the reasons why I think this is a story that's worth telling. It's not the story that you hear about the AIF. Generally, we think of the AIF as this sort of institution of egalitarian bronze diggers, you know, with universal kind of, you know, sense of natural justice, and it certainly wasn't how the nurses experienced it. And now this is this element that Anzac girls... I didn't put a space in. Very sorry about the lack of space between girls and tells. This is one of the most significant things for me as well, and it's what... it's kind of emerging as we approach the centenary of Anzac Day even more strongly, is that because of our attachment to and interest in the Gallipoli story, particularly the April 25 landing, but then the whole of that campaign, it tends to completely overshadow the fact there were 3 more years of war. I mean, that was 8 months. Yeah, it was a rotten 8 months, but it was 8 months. And then the AIF and the New Zealanders and everybody else went off to the Western Front and fought for 3 more years. Yet there were so many other much, much more militarily significant battles. I mean, in terms of military significance, Gallipoli is a blip. It was of no military significance. That's one of the that's the tragedy of it. But in terms of battles which actually impacted the outcome of the war, you've got to go to the Western Front. So I think Gallipoli has overshadowed that. And the fact that nurses also went on to the Western Front is really important too. There were much greater losses, vastly greater losses suffered by Australia and New Zealand on the Western Front than at Gallipoli. In Gallipoli, in the 8 months at Gallipoli, about 8,000 Australians died, which is too horrific to even imagine. At the Battle of Fromelles on July 19, 1916, 5,000 men died in one night. I'm not saying that Fromelles is a more significant battle, but it kind of is. But it's not talked about because Gallipoli has co-opted our whole capacity to commemorate World War I. And Anzac girls, I'm proud to say, we spent half as much time on the Western Front as we did at Gallipoli. And I think we were right in doing that. We couldn't not... Given that how significant Gallipoli is in Australia and New Zealand, we have to tell that story. But then we were absolutely as concerned to tell the Western Front part of the war as well. And that we're able to do that. Right. Now, I'm going to read you a little poem. It's actually a song. It says... I've seen some beautiful flowers grow in life's garden fair. I've spent some wonderful hours lost in their fragrance rare. But I have found another, wondrous beyond compare. There's a rose that grows on no man's land, and it's wonderful to see. Though it's sprayed with tears, it will live for years in my garden of memory. It's the one red rose the soldier knows. It's the work of the master's hand. Mid war's great curse stands the Red Cross nurse. She's the rose of no man's land. Now, that's a lovely song. That's a very lovely song. But to my mind, it really, it kind of diminishes rather than actually honours the work of nurses. It's I mean, deeply sentimental, as which is part of the period. I know that that's part of the period. But it actually doesn't talk anything about what nurses do. And it means that, in general, over time, throughout history, women's work, the work that women do, has tended generally to be trivialised or overlooked or patronised. And I think this, for all of its intense sincerity, is deeply trivialising of what the nurses, what World War I nurses actually did. And I think that that popular image of the ministering angel is actually, it's blocked our capacity to actually understand not only what nurses do, but what these individual women did. It makes it harder to celebrate them because they're just sort of bound up in this sort of, you know, ministering angel things. I've got some ministering angels images for you. Things like this. Like, who had time to do that elaborate hair? And this. I did find in my research that the Rose of No Man's Land is a very, very popular tattoo. Who knew? This image, it's on skin all over the world. But there you go. That's a Rose of No Man's Land. And this, I'm sorry, the image isn't very crisp. That's the image that Rose of No Man's Land song kind of conjures up. And I think that's the image that in the very few dramas that have included nursing, when they're looking at the soldiers, this is what we tend to get. This sort of idea. Now, I really wanted to resist that image and offer an alternative to how military nursing is seen. You know, the Rose of No Man's Land is that it's a derivation of the angel in the house idea from the 19th century about where women should be. The mother and the wife was the angel in the house who somehow glided around and never fought with her children and always had meals on the table. And it's just kind of insidious. And I think it's... And the fact that that kind of has been attached to... nursing is a problem. I'm not suggesting for a minute that people, that the poor men suffering didn't have that sense of, oh my goodness, you feel like an angel to me. You know, that somebody cares for me, that somebody's holding my hand and asking my name and will write to my mother. And I have no doubt that they did have that experience for the men. But I'm telling the story from the point of view of the women. And so that's partly where that idea, why I wanted to kind of challenge it. The other thing is that the as I've said about when I was talking about the pay, the nurses are actually not angels; they're professionals. Like, they're professionals. Back as far as Florence Nightingale, she talks about it as a profession, and to suggest that they're angels and it's somehow a calling is a real problem because it diminishes what they do at some level. This is what they did. That's assisting at a surgery. This is, you know, they don't look like angels here because they've got gas masks on and they're helping a man who was injured put a gas mask on. This is what they did. They did things like this. This is the Carol Dakin, which is an amazing thing. We actually dramatised it in episode 6, this remarkable method of treating septic wounds. Yeah, so they're engaged, intelligent, mature, experienced professionals, not angels. The other problem with nursing in general and military nursing has tended to be depicted as a calling, you know, and to some level it is. Not everybody can do it. Some people have an organic commitment to other people and are able to do that, and that's great. And often those people do become nurses because not everybody can do it because it's so hard. But the trouble with a calling and with an angel is you don't have to pay them. They just do it. They just glide in. They just glide in and do it because they just think it's the right thing to do. No, they should be paid. And so that's another reason why for all the sentiment and kind of love in the Rose of No Man's Land idea, it actually stops them being treated as fully rounded human beings. And so I really wanted to do something about that. Where are we up to? Okay, I wanted to honour the nurses. The on Anzac Parade here in Canberra, there is the Nurses' Memorial, and it was opened in 1999, which is quite a long time after the First World War, you might think, or after the Boer War, because there are actually Australian nurses at the Boer War. Now, New Zealand, by comparison, in 1927 opened a chapel attached to the Christchurch Hospital. There's a nurses' chapel there, and it honours military nursing. Though, now we all think, good on New Zealand for doing that. Look at them and their female emancipation. It was paid for by public subscription, not by the government. So basically the families of the New Zealand nurses raised the money to put up that chapel. But at least it has been there since 1927. Now, and as I said, Australia didn't get a dedicated memorial until 1999, despite nurses having served in every war that Australia's been involved in. The military medal, seven Anzac nurses received the military medal. And the military medal was, we talk about this in episode 6 when we see Alice Ross King go through what she went through to be awarded hers. The military medal was devised by the King, King George, because he realised that other ranks besides officers were doing pretty marvellous stuff, and which deserved to be honoured. And so they created this award, and it's great, and it got given out. Now, it was created for other ranks, and nurses are officers. So, look, I do not want to diminish the fact that the seven nurses won an award, because it's an award for valour. Yeah, for valour, for courage under fire, effectively, which is, yeah, if you've seen episode 6, you see what Alice did during that bombing raid. And I don't want to, and I think it's much better to have an award that had that recognised than not. But it was made for other ranks, and so still I just have this that they didn't. I couldn't quite come at treating the nurses as equals, as officers, because really they should have been able to qualify for, I don't know, George Crosses and VCs and whatever else. You know, but they didn't. And I know it's not the same as actually facing enemy fire. I know that what they were doing is not the same. But at the same time, it's like there's a double standard there, which slightly sticks in my throat. 210 were awarded the Associate Royal Red Cross. That's great. Yeah, that's fantastic and deserved. 56 were awarded the full Royal Red Cross, and Grace Wilson was one of those. And if you look, the stats, it's funny, the stats on how many nurses served, are actually really hard to get, because unsurprisingly, very poor records were kept about their service. So it's never been, all the historians have never been able to arrive at a firm figure, but it's certainly well over 3,000 women from Australia and New Zealand served. But a lot of them didn't only serve with the Australian Army Nursing Service or the New Zealand Army Nursing Service. They went and served, as Elsie does in episodes 5 and 6, they would serve with the Red Cross, or they'd serve with the Queen Alexandra's Imperials, or they served with the Canadians. So many of these extraordinary women were just desperately keen to get over there and help and nurse injured people. They paid their own passage, because the army wasn't going to pay for their passage. So they really were extraordinarily committed. But it does mean that's why records have been hard. Really firm records are hard to come by. Right. On screen, I hope you've all seen Anzac Girls. If you're not, it's available at the ABC shop. if you haven't all seen Anzac Girls, I would urge you to do it. I think it's wonderful. And I just want to explain how all of that, what I've talked about, and I know I've talked a long time, and I'll stop, but how all of that kind of gets embodied into what actually ends up on screen. The first thing is that the nurse's point of view dominates. My intention in writing it and in producing it was there would not be a single scene in which there wasn't a nurse. As it turns out, there are two that they snuck in on me. But they're very minor. We see Colonel Fieschi waking up at one point, and we cut to Elsie's in a phone conversation with her husband, who's at the front, and we have an intercut scene between those two. So really, it's still linked back through Elsie. But the intention was that you don't have point of view, what we call in the trade, point of view, unless you have a nurse in the scene. That half the series is set on the Western Front. Absolutely. We make no bones about that, and we try to accord as much airtime to the whole Western Front campaign as the one in the Middle East. This is nothing, and I know that. I don't tend to read blogs and things about shows I've written on because I get too upset if people don't like them. But I know that some of the criticisms that came up about Anzac Girls quite quickly was, oh, they're doing romances. Oh, there's too much about them just, brushing each other's hair and being friends. I am proud of that, and I think that's absolutely part of it. Because that, again, it's saying that war is only about shooting at people. And actually, war for these people who were there and worked hard and all the things that I've meant your ears about for the last half an hour, they had personal lives. Why should personal lives... The whole point of this story was to say, how do you go on being alive, trying to connect with people when you've been at war for so long? So, and the fact that they did... We didn't make up these romances. I didn't make up Harry Moffat and Alice Ross King falling in love with Harry Moffat, or Olive meeting Pat Dooley and him being shot in the chest and her saying, right, that's it, I'm marrying you regardless. I didn't make up Elsie Cook being married to the former Prime Minister's son and changing, going and enlisting under her maiden name so she could go with him. That's all real. That's all there. And yet, some critics were suggesting that, oh, as soon as you put romances in, it somehow trivialises what they do. I think it actually makes it more spectacular what they do. Then, and along with, Alice's diary is so great. It's an extraordinary document. I would urge you all to read it. It's available at the War Memorial. She's saying, we had 800 men admitted from Anzac Cove last night. I am so tired. I can't look at anybody without crying. I'm going to go into town and buy some new shoes. That's so great, and that's so real. And I know she wasn't at Anzac Cove, so she had the opportunity to go into town and buy new shoes. But just to say that somehow trivialises it, when it's actually a way of dealing with it, and the fact that she and Harry managed to have that heartbreakingly lovely connection so swiftly is part of the story of war, which ought to be told. But it's not told if you think that war is only about blokes shooting at each other. When, as I alluded to at the beginning, Peter Rees's book and the other records as well deals with many, many more nurses than we focused on. But we had to choose. There were so many great stories that we couldn't do because they didn't belong to our people. It was a wonderful story about Pearl Corkhill, who was a great nurse. I think she's from Delegate or somewhere not that far from here. Dalgetty, one of those sort of places. And she... during a bombing raid, she stayed in the tent and went around and put tin basins, like those enamel basins that you'd wash them, on every one of the patients' heads and then stood there like this. And she had shrapnel in her back. Like, that's a great story. I would have loved to have told that story. But, we can't tell every story. So we did select our five people, our five main characters, because they gave us a range of real stories to explore. Poor Grace's brother who was killed at Gallipoli, shot by a sniper, and Olive falling in love with Pat, and Pat being wounded, Alice falling in love with Harry, spoiler alert, he's killed at Fromelles. And Hilda Steele, our Kiwi girl, who trained as an anaesthetist and stood her ground, and this modest little girl stood her ground and trained as an anaesthetist despite lots of pressure not to. So we have been partial in that sense. There were lots more stories we could have told and lots of stories that I would have loved to have told, but you can't do everything. You've only got 6 hours. What else did I want to talk about? I'm almost at the end now. These are the women, these are the actresses who played Anzac Girls. This is Laura Brent, who is nominated for Logie. She played Sister Elsie Cook. This is Caroline Craig, who played Matron Grace Wilson. Seriously, Matron Grace Wilson should be up there as one of our national heroes. And if Weary Dunlop absolutely deserves the praise and the recognition he gets, Grace Wilson should seriously have similar recognition. I know she's from Brisbane. I know they've just they've made a statue of her in Brisbane, which is great. But there should be one here. There should be one at the War Memorial, frankly. She's just extraordinary. This is Georgia Flood, who played Sister Alice Ross King. Anna McGann, who played the lovely Olive Haynes, who's from Adelaide. And this is Antonia Preble, who played Sister Hilda Steele, who's the Kiwi girl. And now I want to finish with... before I go into my last image, The last reason why, and this is back, here's my soapbox, last reason why I really felt it was worth telling the story of Anzac Girls is young women today, honestly, young women today, they would think that you say the word feminism to them and they make the sign of the devil at you and think, what's feminism ever done for me? Well, let me tell you, not that long ago, trained women got paid less than half what untrained men got. That's what feminism's done for you. That people like Elsie Cook were forced to resign because they were married, even though her marital status made her unable to nurse. How? That's never really made clear. All that sort of stuff. I think that young women today have this sense that the rights and equality that they have, they take it for granted, and they've been here forever. They are givens. They are not givens, and they could be very much takens aways if you don't remain vigilant. And if you don't celebrate and honour and recognise and pull apart how those extraordinary steps towards equality were achieved. And the First World War, I mean, I'm certainly not the only person to point this out, the First World War did give women an opportunity to step out of those roles, as indeed did the Second World War, because the men were all off being shot at. So and I think Anzac Girls, if Anzac Girls, reminds one young woman or alerts one young woman to the kind of chauvinism that was just a given, then I think I would be really, really pleased with that. Finally, now in making Anzac Girls and in everything I've said today, I know that I speak for my fellow producers and for the ABC and Screen Time when I say this. At no stage did we want to underplay or diminish what soldiers have done, underplay the service of men in the First World War. I think really what we wanted to do was say, look, this is 100 years on from the war. Surely we're big enough and grown up enough to let that very powerful legend just expand it a little. Just think what it might be like for the other people who served there. What does that, all those things, what do they mean if you just look at them through a nursing lens? And that, that we were really, really, that's really where the kind of impulse to tell the story came from. This, I'm sorry about my terrible picture of Hilda. These are the real women. There's no pictures of Hilda available. So that's Alice. Hilda, tiny little one, which is actually from a group photograph. So I just had to, this is why I had to hit my son up this morning to help me do the PowerPoint because I didn't know how to do it. This is Elsie. This is Grace again on Lemnos. And this is Olive. And, I mean, back to where I began, it's great to be considered a landmark woman, but I tell you, I am a pebble compared to these women, and I think we should give them all a big round of applause, frankly. And thank you. I'm done. No, they haven't.
I was thrilled to. We were discussing Anzac nurses when it first started, the first series, at Sing Australia. And as an ex-nurse training in the 50s under sisters who were about to retire, and so many had not married at the old colonial Parramatta Hospital that was started by the Florence Nightingale nurses being sent out, our actual pianist, who is a director of jazz and many other things, he bounced in and he said, have you seen the start of Anzac Nurses? He said, Olive was my grandmother.
Oh my goodness.
And he said, it was wonderful for my brothers and I, and this man's, late 40s, to actually see how our grandparents met and how they fell in love.
Yeah. Oh.
And he said, she really was a voice grandmother.
Oh, Olive was very feisty. Absolutely. Oh, that's a lovely story. It's very nice. Every now and then I was in contact with lots of the relatives, but not, Olive and Pat had 7 children, so there's a lot of relatives out there.
So his name is Mike Dooley.
Oh,
he's a very
fantastic.
Prominent jazz director and jazz pianist.
Oh, that's lovely.
In Campbell.
Oh, that's great. I should buy him a beer.
Anybody else got?
Hi, that was just wonderful.
Oh, thanks.
I noticed that the photos that you've got, only one of them seems to be a War Memorial photo. Does the War Memorial have photos of all of these women, or did you have to find them elsewhere?
This one of Alice and the one of Hilda, which, as I said, is a group photo, they come from a thing called Grey Scale or something like that. They do, but yeah, this is the only one that we access from the War Memorial. They do have photos of some of them, but we also went for ones that were the best photographs that we could of them. So they've got quite a lot of nursing images, but of particular nurses, not nearly as many as they do of the men. Yeah. Yep. Though I have to say, the AWM were really, really helpful to us. They gave us enormous access to all their maps and, you know, all those maps in the opening title sequence. They're not the real maps, but they're based on maps that the War Memorial let us use. And, yeah, they were great.
Okay,
yeah.
Thanks.
Oh, thanks very much. That's wonderful. I've learned a lot already. I was thinking that whether these nurses obviously, I guess, suffered from, post-traumatic stress, whether there was ever anything available for them. And I reckon there's a whole another series of what happened to them when they came home.
Well, do you want to pitch that to the ABC? look, they did absolutely suffer post-traumatic stress, and not only these nurses. I mean, terribly, like many of the men, it just wasn't something that got discussed. And like all those stories we hear about, your grandfather who just never talked about the war and would have terrible nightmares and drank himself to death, that's, a lot, that those sorts of stories happened for the nurses as well. There was a tragically high suicide rate. A lot of them became, not a lot of them, there were instances of alcoholism and all the same sorts of symptoms that the men, the returned servicemen, were going through. The nurses tended to suffer as well, but they suffered it even more in silence because they didn't have the RSL in the same ways. They didn't have those outlets and they weren't celebrated in quite the same ways. Alice, I was watching, because they reran Anzac Girls recently, in fact, episode 6 just finished last Tuesday, and there was a scene which I wrote, and it got shot, and it got cut, and I wish it hadn't, because it came straight from Alice's diary. It's when she's serving at the casualty clearing station, and she's already gone through the bombing raid, and she's actually writing a letter in her... at the time, and then a plane goes overhead and she's sharing a tent with Hilda, and Hilda wakes up and says, "Do we have to go to the dugout?" And Alice says, "Oh no, they're just heading onto the railway line." And Hilda says, which is a line not particularly from her, it was from some other nurse, but that she said, "Every time I hear the planes now, I get a band of tension here." And Alice says in her diary, "Every time they fly over, I wet my pants." Now, if that's not stress, I don't know what it is. Now, that line got cut, and I was thinking again on Tuesday, why did we cut that line? I wish we hadn't cut that line. I think it's really important. I think it's really important. But, yeah, absolutely, they suffered it dreadfully at the time and for years afterwards. It's not something I think that you get over. Yeah.
Just, I have a comment and a question.
Yeah?
And the comment is that there's never been any mention of these wonderful nurses having to pay to be trained.
No. Oh, right.
Right?
Yeah.
My grandmother was a nurse and a suffragette, and her brother gallantly came forward, and she begged him when she was a widow to pay for her to be trained at the Royal Hospital for Women in Sydney.
Wow.
So that's my comment, is that there was no mention of what they had to go through before they even got to where they were.
Yeah.
The other question is, do you see in 2039 that there will be another series like this about our nurses in the Pacific War?
If I'm around and still at the typewriter, I'd be writing it. Look, I think so. I think this. The short answer is yes, I suspect there would be. There would be, because that's quite a long time away, and I think there would be an appetite for exploring the centenary of World War II in the same way that people have got excited about exploring centenary of World War I. I hope so. But I hope that we don't have to point out all the things that Anzac Girls has to point out, but we probably will. Yeah.
Well, I think they did because, in Australia they came from the voluntary aid in the Red Cross,
right,
to being a nursing service.
That's right. The army, there wasn't a nursing corps in the army until 1951. That's so there was, they were a voluntary reserve service.
Yes, yeah. I was one of the Red Cross.
Oh, well, there you go.
And I can't think of the other thing I was going to make a comment about. But thank you very much. We loved every bit. I then ran off and read the book.
Oh, good.
And I'm glad to see that Anzac Girls is running again on the ABC.
Yeah, so am I. I'd give it that shelf life. We worked so hard on it. I want it to be out there as long as possible. Well,
thank you
very thank
much.
You. That's great.
I think we've got one more question.
Thanks. To what extent, when you were working on developing the series, did you sort of see yourself as part of a bigger dialogue about women's involvement in Anzac? I know people like Alastair Thompson and Kirsty Harris have been writing about it a lot, but also sort of more popular representations like The Crimson Field from the BBC or Tom Keneally's Daughters of Mars. Like, to what extent were you sort of conscious of the sort of wider field of work that you were contributing to?
Quite conscious. Yeah, absolutely, quite conscious. And one of the things I think that sets Anzac Girls apart from the Daughters of Mars and the Crimson Field is that it's based on real people. I know Daughters of Mars is based to a very large extent on Peter Rees's book, but he fictionalises it, whereas we sought not to fictionalise. I mean, it's not a documentary. Anzac Girls is not a documentary. Putting it out there, it's not a documentary. But the liberties we took with the historical fact were considered very, very, very carefully. It had to be any change we made had to measure up against a kind of a whole ethical framework about how you represent the past, how you represent real people. The relatives of the real people, they were very. It's a funny thing. I read Alice's diary, Olive's diary, and they are young women, healthy, lively, having middle class, away from parental restraint, of age, so they are having a pretty good time. I'm having a bad time, but they're engaging in the possibilities of all of that. They're falling in love, they're having flirtations, they're going on dates, they're having arguments with people, all of that. But for the relatives, of course, they're their frail little old grannies. and so the relatives are wanting to preserve. They have quite a different memory of these people than the ones what we wanted them to explore. So yeah, we had to think very carefully about how we represented them, because also we had, though some of the relatives knew their stories pretty well, but lots of them don't, like you were saying. They really didn't know the stories very well. And so when we represented Alice, we showed Alice Ross King in series episode one having various men after her. There's actually four more men that we didn't mention. and I'm not suggesting she did anything immoral with any of them, but she had a lot of, flirtations and relationships. I mean, they were about to go off and be shot at the Dardanelles. I'm not surprised they were, keen to get out there. But I don't think all her family were aware of that. So we had to think very carefully to represent all of that, which is, it's in the historical record, but that would have made her, it would have made her appear like such a flirt that it kind of might have felt uneven, even though it was the case. So we made those sorts of choices. But yes, in answer to your larger question, I was very conscious of that this was going to go out there. Because it was on the ABC, it was going to be accorded possibly more respect than it had, at least the opportunity to be taken more seriously than it had been on a commercial network. So I thought, hopefully it'll hang around and make a contribution.
Thank you. I think the title, Anzac Girls, is absolutely spot on. It's correct. It captures the whole essence of what the series is all about. But ultimately, did the title, including girls, bother you? I'm sure it must have done. And how did you work around that? And what were the issues? And what led to that final outcome?
Look, that is such an interesting question. And we went backwards and forwards about that title, because
several nurses I knew reacted negatively to the word girls. Why are we calling them girls? Why are we trivialising them? Why aren't they women? Because Anzac Women is not a very good title, frankly. if any of you can come up with a better title, I'd love to hear it. We went backwards and forwards about that title, and ultimately I went with girls. We needed the word Anzac in there because we wanted to embody that it was Australia and New Zealand, and it's not just, I couldn't just call it the Australian Army Nursing Service. So that's a bit dull. It sounds like a documentary too. But I felt ultimately justified in sticking with girls because that's how they referred to themselves. The girls and I are going to do this. So-and-so and the other girls came over. We girls are so proud to be here on Lemnos. And also they talked about the boys as the boys. So it was, I think, those terms which are now much more loaded. They've become more loaded. I think these women and men use those terms much more readily in those days. And I'm not entirely sure that it's the right title. I couldn't think of a better one. Australian New Zealand Nursing Service, not quite, that just doesn't have that ring. So.
Well, look, thank you very much, Felicity. And not to take away from that, it's a good juxtapose to remind you all that with all of the stories that come from World War One, please visit our website because there's the Remembering website there with artefacts and exhibitions from the museum where you can talk about the emotions and choose the emotions that tie in. So if you go to our website, there's an opportunity to extend on today's conversation and put your thoughts into that as well. But please join me in thanking Felicity for a wonderful Landmark Women talk.
Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.